Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are in our very fancy DC studios.
Yeah, and it's looking swank.
Well, you were here the very, very first week that we went live, so it's great to have our friend Ben Wittes from Lawfare back again.
Hey, good to be here.
So as I was walking out of the house today in Wisconsin, because I actually flew here this morning, the last thing my wife said to me was, you know, that Ben Wittes piece on what a congressman should ask Mueller next week was absolutely fabulous.
Her check is in the mail.
Well, I mean, I'm just hoping that people read it, because I think one of the more depressing things of the week was to read that Politico story where all the members of Congress say, yeah, we didn't, they admit it, that they didn't read the Mueller report. And like, what's the point? Because then we'd have to worry about it and have to think about it.
Right. So, you know, you have this, you know, it's the ultimate expression of Congress's shedding of its own, you know, responsibilities and authorities, that not only do they have the executive branch do their investigation for them, but then they don't really bother to read the report. And they expect the executive branch officer, in this case, Robert Mueller, to show up and do their jobs for them and explain it all to them. You know, what does it mean? Rather than actually processing it and evaluating it themselves and making their own judgments about what it means. And so we have this ridiculous situation where a guy works for 2 years to produce an investigative product that really Congress should have been doing a lot of itself. They sat out that process. They sit out the process of reading the report, and then they will get mad at him next week for not answering questions that, you know, deliver the evaluative content that they should be generating themselves.
But there's something very human about the avoidance of reading the publication, because nobody likes to have a crisis of conscience. And so if you don't read things that might actually prick your conscience, you're going to be better off, right? They're thinking, I'm not going to speak out about this. I'm not actually going to do anything about it. It's better if I don't know.
So I think the world can be reasonably divided into the people who, when they were assigned group projects in high school, did all the work themselves, and the people who and took on more responsibility than for the group, and the people who did less. And members of Congress are that particularly annoying crowd, which is the people who did less and then claimed credit for it.
That's what they're in Congress.
And yeah. That's, you know, yeah. this is a very frustrating situation for them, where it's really hard to do this job well at this point without having done the homework. And the homework was to read and think about a 438-page document.
So this morning in my newsletter, I cited that Yahoo report that, in fact, it turns out that it was the Russians that planted the whole Seth Rich, you know, Seth Rich did it. They planted that false story, which then, of course, was amplified by the White House, by the White House's friends, by Sean Hannity and the folks at Fox News. And it did strike me as a reminder that we still haven't come to grips with what the Russians did, what they are continuing to do, how we're going to protect ourselves from this, which is why whatever happens next week, and there's a huge potential for it to be a fiasco, that Robert Mueller televised congressional testimony, to quote Joe Biden, is going to be a big effing deal.
Yeah, so I think there are so many layers to this Seth Rich story that I just want to pause over three. One is really hats off to Mike Isikoff, mm-hmm. because a lot of people had forgotten about this story. And he dug very deep. And, you know, I have not listened to the whole podcast yet. I don't think only some of it is out, but he's done a really remarkable piece of written reporting and I think podcast recording. And I think it's a one of the really important answers to disinformation is good investigative debunking of disinformation. And this is a really admirable example of that. The second thing is, as you say, it shows it's another layer of what the Russians were up to. And we can talk about that. But I think it's an important thing when you see conspiracy theories on Fox News or elsewhere. ask yourself where they're coming from, because they're often not, you know, born like, you know, Athena popping out of Zeus's head from Sean Hannity's mind. They're fed from somewhere a lot of the time. And this is a good exploration of the Russian role in a particular type of disinformation. The third point is Russians are not the only people who generate disinformation. And, you know, the problem of giving everybody in the world the ability to speak without editors is that you create, and I'm not against that. Right. There's a lot to be said for it as a matter of democratic participation. You generate a huge amount of irresponsible content. And we still have not solved the problem of filtering that through, you know, means other than what we used to do, which is professional editors.
You know, and I think to your point, it also demonstrates how easy and effective it is to plant these stories.
Exactly.
And that we're not just talking about a few Facebook ads that popped up here or there, or a couple of memes that were on websites like, you know, Rising Patriot Eagle or something like that. This was really something that was in the bloodstream.
Right. So if I had said to you, or to not to you, but to one, and or to say Sean Hannity, hey, I have an idea. Why don't we cook up some garbage through Russian military intelligence for you to feed to tens of millions of people in the United States? He would say, of course not. I don't do that. I express my opinion. And this is a very powerful illustration of the false consciousness that underlies a lot of that, that when you're in the game and you're relying on disreputable sources to throw around your information and to, you know, generate what you think is opinion, what you're actually oftentimes doing is allowing somebody to manipulate the mouthpiece that you have.
I want to talk about the British ambassador in a moment who just resigned this morning after that story was leaked. I know that you wrote something about all of that. But I also want to talk about, I'm just, like I think a lot of other people, I'm admitting that I am obsessed about the Jeffrey Epstein story and what it says about the American justice system, about the culture, this bipartisan oligarchy of sleaze that we're seeing, where somebody who is this connected, this powerful, this influential can get away with something for so long. Just this morning, we have another young woman coming forward and saying she was raped by Jeffrey Epstein. So give me your take on Alex Acosta is you know, defending himself as the former U.S. attorney, saying he got the best deal possible. He got a conviction. He got jail time. He got Epstein registered as a sex offender. What's not to like about that? He's saying now there's new information. But what's your sense about what we've learned about the way that case was handled?
So I have not followed that case particularly carefully. It's a little bit outside of my area, you know, in that it doesn't implicate the national security arena. That said, look, there are times when Alex Acosta's defense of himself would be appropriate. There are times where you know you're dealing with an unbelievable sleazeball. You've got him on X. So you pursue X. Right. And you are kind of maybe aware that there may be other stuff that you don't have, but you go with what you can prove. And later on, it comes out that, you know, this other stuff becomes available. This doesn't quite feel to me like that situation. This feels to me like a situation where, first of all, the deal that they cut was, you know, pretty generous to him. It was fairly lenient. I doubt very much that somebody who was not a political power broker and a person as wealthy as he was would have gotten quite that deal. And given the amount of journalism that subsequently revealed the scope and menace of his behavior, it is a little bit hard for me to imagine that a probing investigation at the time would not have generated more. So I'm skeptical, but as I say, I'm not a It's not a case that I've sort of sunk my teeth deeply into.
Well, and there's also the bizarre simulation that we're living in, that once again we have a sex scandal that involves both Bill Clinton and tangentially Donald Trump.
Well, there is a poetic justice to that.
There's this loop here, and I was just reading before you came over the excerpt from Tim Alberta's book. We'll talk with Tim next week, this bombshell book where he's the fly on the wall, how Donald Trump survived the whole Access Hollywood video. And the way he really survived, and not to have a spoiler, because I think people lived through it, was by going on the offense and saying, but look what Bill Clinton did, that whataboutism, that Bill Clinton did all of this to women. And so we still have, we're caught in this like Twilight Zone loop where it's going to be, you know, the Clintons and the Trumps and whatever, you know, whatever. So let's talk about this British ambassador case. This is such a strange case, where the British ambassador was doing his job. These official cables were leaked. The British government stood behind him rather steadfastly, including Prime Minister Theresa May and the foreign secretary. And yet he resigned this morning. They say unexpectedly. I have a sense it was inevitable, given the fact that the president of the United States, head of state, denounces this guy, calls him names, that he clearly couldn't do his job anymore. But so your take on all that?
Yeah, so a few things. First of all, Kim Darroch is, or Sir Kim, as I should say, because he is a knight, is a genuinely wonderful diplomat. And despite what the president says, is extremely highly regarded in Washington and in British diplomatic circles. He was the national security advisor to the British government before coming here. He's a very, very serious individual. I recently sat down with him on the Lawfare podcast, and we had a kind of wide-ranging conversation about U.S.-British security relations. And one thing you will find if you listen to that interview is that he is, in public, relentlessly diplomatic about Donald Trump. There's a point in that conversation in which I even say to him, wow, you're being very diplomatic. I can't imagine the conversation around Whitehall is quite this complacent about the president. And I could not shake him from at all. I mean, he's a pro. I could not shake him from his, you know, the special relationship is fine. You know, the president is not changed anything fundamental in U.S.-British relations.
Nothing to see here.
No. You know, let's talk about other things. And he was very charming, but he was very emphatic. It is his job as an ambassador to represent his government's policies in public and to advise with unstinting candor in private. And that is exactly what he did. The tone of those memos, those cables that he sent home, which were published over the weekend by the Daily Mail, are rather different from the tone of his conversation with me. And look, every word of what he said is true. And the reason the president is so upset is that a British government official had the temerity to tell his own government the truth.
And probably the same thing that every ambassador, he would certainly not be alone. He would not have been alone.
Bingo. So that's the other thing that is really important for particularly people who are inclined to be supportive of the president or inclined to suggest that maybe he's not that big a deviation from our current, you know, from historical practice. Every ambassador from an allied country is sending home cables exactly like this. There is nothing extraordinary about what Kim Darroch did. What he did was advise his government of the governance reality of the United States and just how messed up it is. And, you know, we shouldn't kid ourselves. What these memos are the thought bubbles, you know, what people are thinking when they're saying the things that we hear them say, that the diplomatic niceties that our allies
are
engaged in.
Well, you know that any diplomat has to tell his home government, you know, what you have to do and how you have to behave if you want to stay on Donald Trump's good side. And you can imagine what that is, you know, make it blunt, make it simple, praise him all the time. This is the way you praise him. This is the way you massage his ego. This is what you don't say. Understand how really deeply insecure he is. I thought one of the interesting fallout of this was, of course, that the cables described him as very insecure. And what does he do? What does Donald Trump do? He basically sets out to prove every single word in those cables to be correct.
Yeah. So I think his reaction is the other important element of this story, and just what fire he's playing with here. So the day after 9/11, General Hayden, who was then the head of NSA, calls his British counterpart, the head of the GCHQ, which is the sort of British version of NSA. And he says to him, if anything happens to this building, and by this building he means Fort Meade, you are in charge of U.S. signals intelligence.
The Brits.
The Brits. He doesn't call the FBI director and say that to Bob Mueller, right? Because he doesn't call the CIA director. He calls his counterpart in British signals intelligence. That is how close our bilateral intelligence relationship is with the British. And so when the president attacks the British ambassador for doing his job, speaking the truth.
We're in downtown Washington, D.C. Things are going on.
Yeah. When the president, attacks the British ambassador for doing his job and speaking the truth, you have to understand the magnitude of the relationship that he's playing with. He's playing with, you know, a relationship that is so close that that we would actively put our intelligence community's assets under the authority of the British in an appropriate national emergency situation. I think that is just worth keeping in mind when you hear the president attack Kim Darroch.
Well, is there long-term damage or is this just a blip? And given the fact that Theresa May is on the way out, Boris Johnson, who's going to be much friendlier with Donald Trump, appears to be on the way in, does this fundamentally change a relationship that deep?
We don't know, right? I mean, first of all, we don't know how long Donald Trump is going to be in office. We don't know how long Boris Johnson, if he ever ascends to power, is going to be in office. We don't know what the next British election will bring. We don't know what the next U.S. election will bring. And we also don't know whether these two men who were both highly eccentric on their own and highly mercurial, who like each other now, will continue to like each other, or whether the president will, find in Boris Johnson somebody who evolves into Angela Merkel, right, over time. And so I think it is really impossible to know. I think what we can say with confidence is that the president is behaving in a way that gravely risks damage to our single or one of a very small number of most important military intelligence and diplomatic alliances.
Well, I want to talk to you about where we're at with the Attorney General and give a little bit of a preview of next week's testimony from Bob Mueller. But before that, I don't know whether you picked out your summer reading. I actually am in Politico magazine saying that I pushed everything aside and I'm going to read Tim Alberta's book. And Brad Thor's book?
Yeah, right now I am working on the copy edits of my own book, yeah. And I can't see past that to what I'm going to read when I'm done. So
well,
I'm not sure.
Okay, so here's a sponsor that actually I would give as my own advice that as you're headed out to the beach, you can listen to Backlash, which is the latest audiobook by number one New York Times bestselling military thriller author Brad Thor, who's been a guest on this podcast. Take a white knuckle thrill ride with Navy SEAL turned covert counterterrorism operative Scott Harvath as he defends freedom by any means necessary. Packed with pulse-pounding action, fascinating characters, and electrifying intrigue, the Backlash audiobook is as current as tomorrow's headlines, proving once again why Brad Thor is known around the world as the master of thrillers. So you can take Backlash with you on your commute to work or on your summer vacation. The audio edition is available on CD and for download wherever audiobooks are sold. I have to admit, I always have those guilty pleasures during the summer.
Indeed.
Okay, Attorney General Bill Barr.
Yeah, so he continues to mystify those of us who were inclined to think well of him when he took office.
That's putting it so diplomatically. So you hang around with these British diplomats.
You know, I was taught if you don't have anything pleasant to say, don't say anything. I'm going to violate that rule. I've found Bill Barr's comportment in a number of areas to be very upsetting and very worrisome, but one I think is sort of particularly ugly, and that is his apparently obsessive interest in investigating the origins of the Russia investigation, yeah. despite lots of people being very clear about what those origins were, and as best as I can tell, there being no particular reason to doubt them. And so, you know, I'm try to keep an open mind. You know, if people want to, if including the Attorney General want to put new facts on the table, I will, of course, evaluate those new facts. But I'm frankly shocked that the Attorney General would be providing grist for conspiracy theories the way he is.
That is probably the most shocking, but right up there is also his willingness to engage in this cover-up. I mean, the most recent comments were essentially, you know, trying to signal to Bob Mueller, yeah, you don't need to go to testify in front of the House of Representatives. It's just going to be a spectacle, and we will provide you, we'll back you if you want to fight that subpoena. And apparently now they're telling Mueller's deputies, we don't want you to testify, even in closed session to the House?
Yeah, so look, the Attorney General has, you know, aided the attempt to stop all of these witnesses from going up. I do think in the long run that will not be an effective thing. I do think eventually, you know, Congress will get to hear from these witnesses. I agree with you that the desire to do that is very striking and ugly.
So you have published a list of questions that congressmen and women should ask next week. They only get 5 minutes. And I thought this was one of the valuable contributions you made, understanding how limited the format is. So what are the most important questions? I know you don't have your piece in front of you.
I can look.
I had confidence.
Let's talk about the principles. So you only get 5 minutes. Now, that's a crazy rule. And Congress should revisit that rule at the earliest possible moment, like today. But let's assume that we go in there with a situation in which you have 5 minutes and then it switches party, which means the tone of the questioning radically shifts. And then they have 5 minutes. And by the way, because you're a member of Congress, you have a strong urge to use 3.5 of those 5 minutes to pontificate yourself and preen, right? And by the way, also because you're a member of Congress, you haven't really thought through what a line of questioning is and how you might use your time most efficiently. You kind of give a speech and then you say, well, don't you agree or something. My three principles for asking questions is, first of all, accept that you only get to make one point. And, you know, you can use a set of questions to make one significant point. If you try to make more than one point, you're going to make less than one point. Number two, Bob Mueller has said he's not going to speak outside of the four corners of the report. If you make him try, you're just going to butt heads with him. And by the way, you have only 5 minutes
yeah, right.
to do that,
yeah.
and he gets to stall. Yeah. So you're not going to win that. So stay within the four corners of the report. Number three, ask yes or no questions, because yes or no questions are controlled and they prevent, at least to a limited degree, they prevent a witness who wants to use up the time from sort of filibustering. Not that I think Mueller would do that, but I think when you ask an open-ended question, you may well get an open-ended answer that is kind of not consistent with your point. So I think if you say those three things, which is, you know, yes or no questions within the four corners of the report that are structured to bring out a particular idea, you can develop some interesting lines of questions within 5 minutes. The one that I proposed on Lawfare is designed to bring out the following idea, which is that Mueller found substantial evidence of obstruction of justice, deferred in the first instance to Congress as to the impeachability of those offenses, and deferred as a criminal matter to the prosecutors after Trump leaves office in the next administration. And I walk through a series of questions that all of which I think he could answer and would answer that would, I think, elegantly highlight that point.
We would all like it to be an elegant and serious presentation. Of course, there's because it's Congress, there's a high probability that it will devolve into a circus as well. And so the Republicans have already, some of the Trump supporters have already telegraphed that they're going to go after Bob Mueller, that they're going to try to rattle him.
Yeah, that's a losing battle.
Okay, why?
Well, I mean, whether you can rattle him is a, but, you know, this is the straightest straight arrow in the world. I mean, there's no,
Visuals will be great.
Yeah, I mean, he is not a charismatic individual. He's not somebody who, you know, people have this idea of the FBI director going out there. They have this vision of Jim Comey, right, who is charismatic and is a great storyteller and who will, that is not Bob Mueller. Bob Mueller is self-consciously dry and will say less rather than more and doesn't want to be there. So he's not going to be, but you're also not going to, you know, if Devin Nunes or Jim Jordan, waves his arms and screams conspiracy theories, you'll look for Bob Mueller to respond with a monosyllable.
No, I think it's going to be very dramatic just because of that. But do you get the sense, because I know that you were, you know, deeply engaged in following what was going on with the Mueller report and did the readings of the Mueller report. Has the window already closed or passed? Have the Democrats already blown it? Because there's part of me that thinks, okay, there's so much substance there, and I think it's going to be very dramatic next week, but it feels so long ago that this report came out. The bar spin seems to have been far more effective than you or I would have guessed at the time. And the Democratic response seems weaker and less focused than I think we had hoped.
So I'm not sure it's that the bar spin was more effective, honestly. I think it was that the Democratic, depending on your perspective, either failure of nerve refusal to take the bait, if you want to take a sort of more admiring posture toward Nancy Pelosi, or, as I am inclined to think, simply flailing ineptitude of logistics in response, created a very long time lag, and they didn't kind of get off their feet and figure out what they wanted to do and what they wanted the next set of steps to be. And the result of that is that there's, you know, however many weeks or months have passed, and there's been sort of no substantial factual development. And that, I think, makes it very difficult to sort of pick up the ball now and, you know, do something dramatic, with one important caveat, which is that Trump is the gift that keeps on taking away. And, you know, every time you think the fact base is stable, we learn something dramatically new. And I do think all bets are off the next time there is some substantial factual development in this area.
So do you know, I don't know how this actually works. Does Jerry Nadler get all the Democrats together in a room with scripts and hand out and go, okay, let's divvy this up. You're going to ask this question. You're going to ask this question. Don't do this. Is there going to be preparation? Do they do that sort of thing? Or do you have 20 just egos going their own way?
Well, it's much more the latter than
okay.
the former.
I was afraid of that.
There are attempts to get the always, you know, attempts to have a certain degree of coordination. And actually, to their credit, the Republicans in government reform in the Michael Cohen context, a lot of them gave their time to Jim Jordan. And so he was able to develop some sustained lines of questioning. The problem is, of course, that, Jim Jordan is a little crazy. In some contexts, they are able to coordinate. the egos do tend to be the dominant feature.
Yeah, well, that is Congress. Okay, very, very quickly in the time we have left, a couple of cases. Win for the White House on the emoluments case, the appeals court, essentially saying that D.C. and Maryland, it was D.C. and Maryland, lack standing to bring the emoluments charges against the president. As far as I know, the Supreme Court has never ever ruled on what the emoluments clause means or how it should be enforced.
Yeah. So, look, this opinion came down this morning yeah. And I haven't read it yet. The Fourth Circuit panel that issued it is probably not representative of the center of gravity of the Fourth Circuit right now. And so look for an en banc appeal.
Which all the judges in that
exactly. circuit. Exactly. And you know, this panel is significantly more conservative than the en banc Fourth Circuit. That said, I think both the standing issue here and the substantive issue is a genuine issue of first impression in U.S. constitutional law. There aren't that many provisions of the Constitution that have no authoritative judicial interpretation, but the emoluments clause is one of them. And you know, that's partly because presidents haven't really been
it's
in
never
the business
come up before.
Of running yeah. hotels stayed in by foreign yeah. guests.
No, nobody ever had Saudi princes coming and dumping lots of money into a property that they owned that goes into their pockets. This has not happened before. Perhaps it wasn't necessarily envisioned. Is that an emolument? It's a fascinating question.
It's a fascinating question. It's a legit question. It's a question on which you can make reasonable arguments on both sides. It is also a question that is not going to be decided by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, either at the panel level or at the en banc level. It's going to be decided by the Supreme Court. So this decision is a step along the way to a genuinely important confrontation that's going to happen over this clause sometime in the next few years.
The other thing that has people's hairs standing on end, hair standing on end, is the challenge to Obamacare in front of another appeals court panel, where the judges appeared to be asking some very, very tough questions about, well, why shouldn't we throw Obamacare out since there's no longer any sort of a tax penalty? This is, to use the oldest, most overused cliche in American politics, this really is the dog that might catch the car that would not know what to do with. I mean, be careful what you wish for. The worst thing that would happen, I think, to Republicans would be to win this suit, to have the court throw out all of Obamacare because they have no plan B. There is no congressional or administrative plan to replace Obamacare if it's thrown out by the courts.
Yeah, so I think, you know, there is a be careful what you wish for on the winning side. There's also a political problem in that regard, which is, you know, if you win this, can you imagine the juice that would add to Democratic voter mobilization if once again the fate of Obamacare were actually on the table and that it were somehow connected to this other animating issue for Democrats of judicial nominations? You know, that's a, you know, going into an election year. And so I you know, the legal merits of it aside, I do think it is a political minefield.
Ben Wittes, thanks so much for coming in again. Appreciate it very much. Good to see you.
Great to see you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow.